I forgot the verse. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. And then I remembered. So I got a different computer. It's the one from the office. And so it's a little bit unfamiliar to me, but I'm curious. Can you hear okay? Yeah? Seems okay? Okay, good. That's the weirdest thing about Zoom is you have no idea what the people on the other side are perceiving. Which is true live too, but, you know, it's easier for us. There's
friendly background noise.
Yeah, there's like this really loud fan in the computer, which I don't know how to turn off, which I'll... I've been tempted for the last hour and a half to try to work on it, but I will refrain myself and just speak up, and I'll try to fix it for next time. That's the background sound being created by the computer itself. Anyway, so it's wonderful to be back in the seat, and it was really just so helpful to have such an open and flexible July, so thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks especially to Kate and John and Chris and Scott and Edie and Bob for giving talks the last 6 weeks. And so important to remember about these teachings, you know, over and over again. The six paramitas are just such a great plan, you know, a good blueprint for living. Good to just kind of check ourselves out once in a while, right? How am I doing with generosity and living in an upright way and being patient as I'll get out, you know? Energetic, right? Energetic. Am I practicing? Am I focused? And wisdom. And I enjoyed the sort of inherent political spin of Edie's wisdom talk. She was actually quoting people, but somehow she still made it kind of political. That the wisdom beyond wisdom, the Prajnaparamita of being able to face uncertain, confusing, weird times with steadiness, with stability, right, which we sure need right now. So thanks everybody and all the other things that are going on. It's unbelievable. We're very engaged and busy, even in the middle of COVID. And you'll hear more about all this as we go forward, but kind of the project for the fall is to really think about, okay, well, how do we kind of do a complete-ish, full kind of Zen training online? Because apparently that's what we're doing for reals. You know, this isn't just a temporary emergency measure until we get back to the real thing. This is the real thing, actually. Life is always the real life, right? So it kind of all fits. Well, I can't resist continuing my koan project because I'm almost done. And tonight's koan is a story we actually already talked about. It's another Bodhidharma story, which actually I've forgotten. There were so many Bodhidharma stories in the Mumon Kan, and the Mumon Kan is just a kind of the basic source book of Zen stories. So, of course, there's going to be a lot of Bodhidharma, such famous stories. And the story of tonight's case 41, includes one of the violent episodes that we already talked about, actually, but it also includes a really useful and powerful practice pointer on the way that we so easily get lost in the contents of our minds, of our life, all the busy details. We all are so familiar with this. And wouldn't it be great to have the supportive practice and the supportive teachings to encourage us to deal with the contents well, yeah, of course, but also be able to retain some awareness of the process and of the awareness itself. And also tonight's story, and all the Bodhidharma stories, as dramatic as they can be, not to get lost in the drama and the violence, whether the real violence happened or not, but also to appreciate just the expression in these stories of spiritual longing and journey, you know, and just that kind of go forward energy, that virya energy that Kate talked about some weeks ago. And that's in the koans and the Bodhisattva Dharma stories, and it's just all through the tradition. And so before we actually get back to Bodhi Dharma, I want to share with you a few poems. These are a poem. This is an amazing thing, you know, and we haven't studied this as a sangha yet, so it's well time to at least dip into this collection. But somehow, the enlightenment poems of the very first Buddhist woman were remembered, you know, and then eventually written down, but for hundreds of years they were recited and remembered like the rest of the Buddhist teaching. So the first nun's words were treated, you know, in a way as just important as the Buddha's words. And the collection is called Terigata. Teri just means nun, and gata, you've probably heard, is like a poem, a meditation poem. And there's a couple recent, couple years, new translations, an academic one and a more kind of poetic, fluid one. So I want to read translations from the more fluid one, which is called The First, I don't know if you can see that, The First Free Woman. New translation of the Terigata selections. This isn't a complete text, by someone named Maddie Weingast. And so I just want to appreciate the sense of journey and longing and power. And that these are the stories of women, you know. The Bodhidharma stories have a lot of testosterone in them, no question. You know? So here's some other ways of looking at the same thing. In the original text, the stories are all just entitled with the name of the nun that said them. Ah, here's Bodhidharma now. Thanks, Chris. That's awesome. We'll get to you, buddy. Don't worry. Maddie Weingast gave other titles too, but I don't think that they're original, so I'll just say the name of the woman in her translation. So the first song, three. First one is by Mitakali. And I think it's a wonderful example of how meditation might work. Mitakali. I was always smart. If the path was good, I figured it would make me even smarter. One night while meditating, I watched my thoughts piling up all around me. My mind built a house out of all those thoughts, and they filled that house. And soon it was a whole city, a whole world. Oh, my beautiful, beautiful thoughts. Who will look after you after I'm gone? I swear I could weep a week for all of you. My sisters, do you really want to be free? Are you ready to leave behind all your precious little houses and make your home everywhere? It's not as hard as you might think. First, stand up. Then, walk out the door. Isn't that great? Doesn't that match your experience? Haven't you just now been busy making houses and cities and landscapes and, you know, traffic, and you have traffic jams probably in your city? I'll read it again. This is Mitakali. I was always smart. If the path was good, I figured it would make me even smarter. One night while meditating, I watched my thoughts piling up all around me. My mind built a house out of all those thoughts, and they soon filled that house. Soon it was a whole city, a whole world. Oh, my beautiful, beautiful thoughts. Who will look after you after I'm gone? I swear I could weep. I could weep a week for all of you. My sisters, do you really want to be free? Are you ready to leave behind all your precious little houses and make your home everywhere? It's not as hard as you might think. First, stand up and walk out the door. And here is a poem from Sakula. and wonderful. She's talking pretty directly about gender roles. And remember, this is like 500 BC, you know, in India. Sukula. I once gave all of myself to being a wife and mother. Then I heard the teachings of the Buddha. I saw the arising and passing away of what was wife and said goodbye to my husband. I saw the arising and passing away of what was mother and said goodbye to my children. What was left I gave to the path. Oh, my sisters, you never had to be perfect. If there is something in these teachings calling out to you, it is because something in you is calling out to these teachings. The path will take you whenever you're ready, just as you are. If there is something in these teachings calling out to you, it is because something in you is calling out to these teachings. The path will take you whenever you're ready, just as you are. Wisdom, huh? Here's one by Sundarinanda. Sundarinanda. This one is wonderfully inclusive of everything to do with the body. I don't usually hear this kind of text from the koan, so listen to Sundarinanda. One morning, after another long night, I was squatting on the toilet, watching it all come out. For the first time, I saw my body. Not just how it looks, but what it does, what it is, turning what is dear into what is waste. I got up and started walking. As the sun was setting, I passed a graveyard. You, my sisters, beneath the leaves. And as I am, so once you were. You, my sisters beneath the leaves, as I am, so you once were. As you are, so will I become. There I slept. There I stayed, examining this mass of flesh and bones, contemplating the many masses of flesh and bones gently rotting just beneath the ground. Then one morning I saw, what goes in must come out, not just the body, but the mind. What will you bring into the world other than what gets washed down the toilet? Isn't that awesome? Dharma poem about shitting and death. These women were just right there, you know. Wonderful. They can inspire us from all those thousands of years before. So, and here's the koan version of that enthusiasm for practice. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second ancestor stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind cannot be at rest. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." "Bring your mind here and I'll put it to rest," replied Bodhidharma. "I've searched for my mind, but I cannot find it," said the second ancestor. "Now your mind is pacified," said Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second ancestor stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind cannot be at rest. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." "Bring your mind here and I'll put it to rest," replied Bodhidharma. "I've searched for my mind and I cannot find it," said the second ancestor. "Now your mind is pacified," said Bodhidharma. So this koan is extra super condensed, and it's combining multiple stories and many years of practice into one paragraph. You would think, I mean, even though Chinese is very kind of condensed and efficient, they probably have a character that is like later on or something like that. I don't know why they don't put that in there to help us, but they don't. So part of the heroic mythology of Bodhidharma is he really just was so committed to his own practice, you know. He wasn't looking for students. He wasn't trying to start a temple. I don't think he particularly meant to have any interviews with emperors, but, you know, he got invited, so he went. And after his famous interview with Emperor Wu in the country of Liang, this is like before China was unified, and one of the times it wasn't, he takes off deep into the country and far into the center and even crosses the border to another country, the northern country of Wang, something like that. And he finds a cave, you know, and he just says, I'm just going to sit here and practice. That's what I'm about. That's what I want to do. The story is for 9 years all by himself, he faced the wall in this cave. But eventually word gets out, right? Even without social media. And he notices a visitor waiting, you know, waiting to be recognized, you know, waiting for him to look up. There was a door, maybe waiting outside the door. Who knows if there was a door? So in classic Zen fashion, he ignores him for some time. And that is enshrined in Zen tradition, actually. That's the sort of waiting outside the gate. And maybe we should bring some form of that into our Red Cedar practice. We've never had that in our practice overtly. In the Zen monasteries, there's a special room by the gate where you have to sit and wait for some days before you're admitted to the monastery proper. And the room is called the Tamgaryo. And so at the big monasteries in America too, you have to do special extra practice at the beginning of a practice period or when you're trying to be admitted. And the practice gets called the same name as the room, Tamgaryo. So anyway, the second ancestor is an early practitioner of Tamgaryo, whether he likes it or not. And eventually he does something, you know, to show his commitment, which in our case now is to just sit zazen and not run away. So, did he really cut off his arm? I don't doubt it. But this is not to trivialize or say this wasn't in some way a part of our tradition from Asia. Different culture, different time. But this tradition carried on into the modern age. Not cutting off your whole arm, but it's not uncommon in the 19th and 20th centuries and before to cut off a part of your finger. Really show how serious you are and how committed. And I've never met anybody who did this practice, but I've met people who have met people who did this practice, so it's only a step removed, you know, from me, from us. And it's dramatic and crazy to us, right? But this is, you know, passion, right? This is the path, right? This is another expression of journey and no turning back. In the Mindfulness Sutra, early Pali Sutra, they say that when you practice deeply, it's like a one-way road. There's no turning back. Ekyayana, no turning back, one-way road. So anyway, the second ancestor who, after his ordination, becomes named Weko, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it, practices with Bodhidharma for many years. And sometime in there, he recognizes how disturbed his mind is, you know? Do you recognize this too? We all do. And I don't think that happened the second he got in the door, you know? I think he probably did everything, but, you know, Bodhidharma probably didn't say much at all, but he followed Bodhidharma's example and learned by, as an apprentice, you know, how to be a serious Zen meditation student. And what I imagine is after maybe some years of hardly saying a word, you know, taking care of chores, taking care of the teacher, sitting a lot, he just couldn't stand it anymore, you know. His teacher seems so composed, right, so stable. And he's been doing all this stuff and it's like it's not working, right? Do you know this feeling? So embarrassing, so hard. Mind so agitated. So the way I believe is eventually he just blurted this out, you know, maybe in the middle of meditation or something. My mind isn't at rest. Please help. pacify my mind. And Bodhidharma says, and this is a kind of brilliant redirection of the Zen teachings, you know. Okay, bring me your mind. Bring me your mind. I'll pacify it for you. I'll help you. You can show me. Sometimes it's translated, show me your mind. Which isn't exactly answering the question, right? The teacher doesn't get so caught by techniques or practice plan or giving good advice, you know. Have you tried reducing your screen time or, you know, anything like that, right? Just brings it out, it brings another angle, you know, another approach, another way of thinking about it. And by asking the student to show me your mind or bring me your mind, pointing out that Weka here and all of us probably seated here have certain assumptions about the solidity and the reality of the mind, and the mind is me, and the mind is this thing that does thinking and worrying. And the mind is freaked out, and if only that mind could be fixed and better and calmed down, and what? How do you do it, you know? Since the mind is self-improvement, right? And so, Weka got back to work, you know, back to practice, and maybe some more years pass, we don't know. And he's like, well, what is this mind, you know? You can see he starts to recognize probably the thoughts coming and going, you know, and the energy and the moods and the wildness in there. But what is it that's having these moods? What is it that's thinking these thoughts, you know? What is it that's worried about politics, you know? And this is Dogen's turn, the backward step, right? This is Dogen's turn the light inwardly and illuminate yourself. And this is emptiness, right? And, you know, there's concept here, and we're talking about it with language, and there's stories about it, and woodles of long, long sutras. During the sabbatical, I started, I didn't get that far, to be honest, but I started the Flower Ornament Sutra. I know Chris tried to read a few chapters of that and survived to tell a tale. But did you read the whole thing? Did you really? Whoa! Amazing. Twice? I wonder you're enlightened. But anyway, there's endless, like, words about all this. But in the end, right, transformationally, it's an experience of some kind. And the story doesn't try to tell us what the experience was for Weka. I mean, it's up for each of us to find this out for ourselves and to feel whatever it is for each of us. But something shifted, right? He realized in a deeper, in some deep way, that the mind, the nature of the mind was not what he was thinking. It wasn't that way after all. Teacher, I can't find my mind. I thought there was something, but I don't see it. What, I don't, it's not that. And who knows if Bodhidharma's last sentence in this story, now your mind is pacified, whether that was just an acknowledgement, not just, but that's powerful to be acknowledged, right? That's big. Or maybe that statement too was a turning pointer for Weka as well. Now your mind is pacified. Maybe he sat with that for some more years. Like, okay, now my mind is pacified. What is my mind? For a while, I really appreciated sitting with questions, you know, and this helps with this kind of thing as well. But just sitting helps, and just living helps, and just being curious about our assumptions helps. It's a deep pattern, right? It's a deep, deep habit to think that we are our thinking, and that our thinking is real in the way that we think it is, and that it's upsetting and urgent and exciting and wonderful and terrible and all these things. One way to think about it is, well, there's something that's aware here. Aware of a crazy thought, aware of a plan, aware of a worry, aware of depression. You know. But is the awareness itself worried, you know? Is the awareness itself excited? Is the awareness itself depressed? It can be a helpful thought, but that's also just a thought. But a wonderful story to encourage us really invest time and energy in sitting with the fundamental question of what is mind? What is this? Who is this? What is this moment? That this is part of what we can offer to the world, that this is transformational and powerful. That this backward step is important. So is the forward step, right? Bolstered and informed by even our approximate, half-baked, rough idea of what the Dharma is and what practice is and what we can be, we still need to move forward, right? Out into the world, engaging with this crazy, burning world as best we can. So we need the backward step and the forward step. And we need Black Lives Matter. So the day it was a while before it all got started, I had the first session of the class I'm taking, which I hope, once I've taken it, to facilitate for us, and maybe there's other classes we'll find out about, or other facilitators, even better, we'll see. But anyway, a class called Awakening to Whiteness, created and run by the Zen community of Oregon, of course on Zoom, so it was a lot of Portland people, but also people from all over. Powerful stuff, right? And stuff we also there need to be able to take both the backward step. Who am I, you know, in this world of race and privilege and inequality, and the forward step. How do I engage with that? How do I help? How do I acknowledge it? One of the pieces we listened to was a 10-minute radio piece, an African-American woman talking. It sounded like to a white audience, so it sounded like she was talking to me. And she was saying, our people are dying from this. So you may need to feel a little uncomfortable for us to make change. And then she went on to say, you may need to feel more than a little uncomfortable. So I was sitting in a circle today online, being uncomfortable and studying this. And it made me think about the sense that part of why racism got so entrenched is the privileged class, which so many of us are descendants from, beneficiaries of, we just can't see it. We can't see the breadth of it, you know, and the depth of it, and the power of it, and the momentum of it. We see just a glimmer of it or something. And it made me think of a metaphor in a poem, Naomi Shihab Nye's poem, Kindness, which you might know, I'm sure I've shared it more than once. One of those poems you can't hear too many times. So that we all know what the metaphor is, I'll read the whole poem, and then I'll point out the metaphor again. This is the backward step and the forward step, right? So here's Naomi Shihab Nye's poem, Kindness. Before you know what kindness is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all of this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out of the windows forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel. Where the Indian in the white poncho lies dead by the side of the road, you must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread, only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say it is I you have been looking for and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. So this fourth stanza, that before you can really know kindness, you must know sorrow. Wake up with sorrow and speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. So I was realizing today, maybe anti-racism education is that, you know, is actually seeing the size of the cloth, which is overwhelming, right? Because it's infinite, you know, it's huge. It's Indra's net. Let's close with one more poem from the Terigata. This one's like a little racy. We need it all, yeah? This is Nandutara. Nandutara. I spent most of my teenage years running from one bed to another. Any sign of warmth would do. Each worked for a while until they got possessive or mean or boring. Or I did. Then I got new friends, shaved my head, and started eating once a day. During the long, lonely nights that followed, I would remember all the nice warm baths, all the late nights and long mornings, waking up next to beautiful warm bodies. One night, shivering on the ground, I started to cry. It's not fair. No matter what I do, the other thing always looks better. Listen, my heart. I know how exhausting it all gets. Don't give up until you're ready to give up for real. I spent most of my teenage years running from one bed to another. Any sign of warmth would do. Each worked for a while, till they got possessive or mean or boring, or I did. Then I got new friends. Shaved my head and started eating once a day. During the long, lonely nights that followed, I would remember the nice warm baths, the late nights, the long mornings, waking up next to beautiful warm bodies. And one night, shivering on the ground, I started to cry. It's not fair. No matter what I do, the other thing always looks better. Listen, my heart. I know how exhausting it all gets. Don't give up until you're ready. Give up for real. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Actually, let's not do frustration right now. I kind of got the order. Let's just check in for a minute, and then we can do frustrations and refugees. So this fan is really distracting me a little bit. That's all right. Wrong button. Well, I can only mute you. I can't unmute you. That can happen there, too. So you have to unmute yourself if you want to say something. I'll stop recording.